Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 971. Nazis in New Orleans. This is being recorded on August 28th of the year 2017. In this program, we are going to examine one of the, I guess one could say, the touchstones of the research that I've been engaged in over close to four decades. Oh, really, I've been on the air for close to four decades and have been doing the research for about five. The entry point to this entire endeavor, such as it is, was the assassination of President Kennedy. Having come to that incident or that investigation as a result of examining Watergate and what Richard Nixon was doing in Dallas, Texas on November 22nd, 1963, I began looking at that event in depth, and not only did it become apparent readily that the official version of events was completely wrong, but even perhaps more importantly, a serious investigation of the various aspects of President Kennedy's assassination yields a tremendous understanding of things that have gone on over the last roughly a century. In The Guns of November, the four-part series available on Spitfire, done in 1983, the Kennedy assassination is compared to the waste of an hourglass. Indeed, from the events in Dallas, Texas on November 22nd, 1963, one can go back in time and examine important aspects of the assassination, or really the rise of fascism, I should say, and how major players such as Sullivan and Cromwell lawyer Alan Dulles, or Warren Commission member John J. McCloy, described as the chairman of the board and someone tabbed by Richard Nixon to serve in a key capacity in the Watergate cover-up, really, not investigation. One can examine people like McCloy and Alan Dulles and see their profound connections to Wall Street, and even beyond that, to the international cartel system, of which German corporations, IG Farben and others, Vereinigte Stahlwerke, later Thyssen AG, which embraced the Bush family and linked them to German heavy industry. Those connections, as they evolved through the 20s and 30s, then up through the 1940s, as they recoalesced at the end of World War II and took their positions as critical drivers of the Cold War, one then sees the, what an author we're going to be dealing with here terms, the radical right in the country in the 1930s, continuing apace through the 1940s, evolving untouched through the 1950s, and then one can see that milieu's participation in the assassination of JFK. As I am speaking on August 28th of 2017, excuse me, there is much chatter about Donald Trump and the events of Charlottesville. We will be examining Charlottesville to a certain extent in the context of what we're going to be looking at today at greater length in For the Record 972. And one of the, well, several things that should be noted here. The analyses of Charlottesville and the reactions to Charlottesville have been predictably, and I'm going to be on the air with this, so I will edit my true feelings. They are unsatisfactory. If I were to express myself candidly, I would have to reach into the foulest backwaters of my vocabulary. And suffice it to say, as we will make quite clear in For the Record 972, they are all bound on the wheel, is the main part of that title from a Robinson Jeffers poem, Be Angry at the Sun. The reactions to the events in Charlottesville are completely inadequate and in many cases ludicrously uninformed and or hypocritical to an almost unbelievable degree. Suffice it to say that what took place in Charlottesville was not only frankly predictable, but that what people were seeing at a superficial or iconic level were things and people and events that have a much deeper historical and ideological context. For most of the program that we are going to be presenting today, we're going to be drawing material from a very large, a very important, and also a very flawed book, one that I would recommend for seasoned researchers who can do the necessary, and it is very necessary, handicapping of the book. The book is called General Walker and the Murder of President Kennedy. It's authored by Jeffrey, J-E-F-F-R-E-Y-H, Caulfield, C-A-U-F-I-E-L-D, M-D, published in hardcover by the Moreland Press and copyright 2015. The book explores what the author calls the radical right and his view, correct as far as it goes, that the radical right was deeply involved with the assassination of JFK, and he makes it quite clear that that extends to Martin Luther King and President Kennedy's brother Robert Kennedy as well. Now, I spoke of it as a flawed book. It is, in an important respect, fundamentally flawed in that Caulfield dismisses notion of the intelligence community's role in these assassinations and in the assassination of JFK in particular. What is quite apparent when one reads the book is that the forces that Jeffrey Caulfield identifies correctly, as far as he goes, with their involvement in the assassination of JFK, when examined in a larger operational and historical context, those elements function as an extension of elements of the intelligence community. They overlap the intel community very heavily, although they are not coterminous with the intelligence community, the CIA in particular. They, in fact, in many ways function as an extension of it. The dismissal by Caulfield of notions of intelligence community in JFK's assassination is incorrect, and the tone he takes in places is something I find off-putting. My guess is other researchers have as well. Nonetheless, it is a huge book with appendices and indexes and bibliography going almost 300 pages, and the main body of text is something like 790 pages. So it is a formidable tome. And again, I think for a seasoned researcher who can do the next necessary handicapping, it is very valuable indeed, and I think the great flaws in the book, notwithstanding, with the necessary handicapping, I think we can view Caulfield's work as an important, albeit flawed, and in spite of its enormous length, limited contribution to the investigation of Kennedy's assassination. It may well be that elements of the intelligence community helped Caulfield with his investigation. I don't know that that was the case. Say when you are with CIA, you're 35 years old, and you discover that the organization for which you work was involved in all sorts of unsavory things, including the fusing of U.S. intelligence to the Third Reich's intelligence system under Reinhard Galen, and beyond that to the underground Reich governed by Martin Bormann and administered by Heinrich Müller, the former chief of the Gestapo. And when you discover that, among other things, that your boss or the agency for which you work and for which your salary and your 401k program, your pension, your family's livelihood, or perhaps their safety, if you should decide to turn against your master, what do you do? Well, you might come out with some modified limited hangout. Could also be that Jeffrey Caulfield just did not want the agency up his rear end for the rest of his professional life. And I could understand how someone might be of that persuasion under the circumstances. Nonetheless, I think with the necessary handicapping, this is a valuable book. So we are going to take a look at the radical right, as Caulfield terms it, a number of overlapped investigations, the American Nazi, a number of overlapped organizations, the American Nazi Party, the National States Rights Party, the Ku Klux Klan, the John Birch Society, and the Minutemen, a paramilitary organization with members in all of these groups, and many of whose members functioned as operatives at the operational level in the effort against Fidel Castro's Cuba. That operation obviously also heavily overlaps the killing of JFK, as we have seen in so many programs. Another of the things that I think we need to take note of before we actually delve into Caulfield's formidable tome is that I believe many of these organizations, these overlapping far-right or really American fascist organizations, what is, and I hate the term, called today the, quote, alt-right, unquote, the ANP, the American Nazi Party, the National States Rights Party, the Ku Klux Klan, the John Birch Society, the Minutemen. These are organizations that I believe functioned as part of a domestic Gladio program. We took a look at some ruminations in that regard by the brilliant Kevin Coogan, the author of one of the very best books about fascism and an invaluable work in and of itself, Dreamer of the Day, Francis Parker Yockey and the Post-War Fascist International. Operation Gladio, as we have seen, was an American intel and NATO and Galen operation to use fascist groups in various European countries as what were termed stay-behind elements. They were to function as an anti-communist underground in the event of either a successful Soviet invasion of Western Europe, something that would not have taken place, that was impossible given the advent of nuclear weapons and other things, or in the event of a peaceful or democratic ascension to power of various communist parties. In the event, Operation Gladio or Operation Stay Behind morphed into things like the strategy of tension in Italy and various right-wing terror incidents under Operation Gladio, often represented and deliberately misrepresented as actions by the left. I believe that the assassination of JFK at the level we are going to be looking at, and again, U.S. intelligence was heavily involved, really involved elements of a domestic Gladio. The notion that the U.S. would have helped put together something like Gladio using fascist groups in Europe as potential cadre and would not have done the same here in the event of a communist takeover simply defies belief.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
Also, what we're going to be looking at here are events that, when tracked back in time, go to the pre-war Fascist International and evolve into what Kevin, the aforementioned brilliant Kevin Coogan, referred to as the post-war Fascist International. We're also going to be looking at how many of these events or institutions and people evolved into elements of, and forgive me, the quote, alt-right, unquote, something that makes me want to alt-puke all over the goddamn board here. But I think I'll refrain under the circumstances, as potentially necessary as that might be. We're going to take a look in particular at one of Lee Harvey Oswald's Nazi associates in both New Orleans and Dallas, a guy named Ray Lehart, or Lehart, L-E-A-H-A-R-T, who was an associate of Guy Bannister's and who ultimately moved through the, quote, alt-right, really the fascist street Nazi level in the U.S. and became the best man at David Duke's wedding on September 9th of 1972. David Duke, of course, a key member of domestic fascist organizations, best known as a Ku Klux Klan member. He also got his start with the American Nazi Party of George Lincoln Rockwell, and is networked with people like Ron Paul, Eddie Snowden's political guru, and the milieu of WikiLeaks and the milieu of Glenn Greenwald, and the individuals and institutions that the so-called progressive sector has been hailing for years and that the mainstream media have been hailing for years. They helped to destabilize Barack Obama and then Hillary Clinton. And after 48% of the eligible voters did not turn out in the 2016 election, which featured on the Republican side a candidate who kept a copy of Hitler's speeches in his night table by his bed for nighttime reading, that was called My New Order by Adolf Hitler, a sequel to Mein Kampf, and by a grand total of 77,000 votes, Donald Trump became president of the U.S., while the mainstream media obsessed on Hillary Clinton's emails, while the so-called progressive sector castigated Hillary Clinton and oohed and aahed all over Bernie Sanders, failing to take note of a lot of important things about Bernie Sanders, oohing and aahing over the fact that Hillary Clinton gave some speeches to major commercial banks, then gave the six-figure speaking fees to banks. Now, with a president whose sympathies with people in Charlottesville are a matter of public record, people are shocked, shocked. Well, they shouldn't be, because they helped to bring this to pass. We're also, at the end of the program, going to touch on elements that bear directly on what is going on in Ukraine and the elements who have, and the individuals who have, so disgustingly postured, saying, oh, it's terrible that Donald Trump didn't condemn the fascists in Charlottesville. These are individuals who are at least as guilty of that hypocrisy, and in my opinion, greater hypocrisies, with regard to the milieu of the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, its heavy overlap with the Republican Party, its fundamental connections to what is going on in Ukraine today. These people have ignored it or even covered it up and spun it in the opposite direction. And now they're disturbed by what is happening. They say, how could this be taking place? Well, there is nothing else that could be taking place, and they are part of it. The Republican Party, the mainstream media, the so-called progressive sector, all bear blame for what has taken place. So we're going to dive back into the evolutions of the alt-right. We're going to be looking at the pre-war Fascist International, the post-war Fascist International, overlapping groups that I believe were part of a domestic Gladio operation, links to international fascism, to the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, an organization of Eastern European fascists that was linked by the SS, and it was originally called the Committee of Subjugated Nations when it was formed by Adolf Hitler in 1943, an organization that is deeply connected to what is going on in Ukraine. And we're going to see how these organizations link with the, quote, alt-right, unquote, as it was involved in the assassination of JFK. Now, bearing in mind that they were functioning at the street level, controlled by elements of the intelligence community, and even beyond that, by powerful Pentagon and Wall Street players, and beyond that, by the fascist international and the international cartel systems. By the way, this, I believe, domestic Gladio milieu also permitted a modified limited hangout. And it could be blamed on the radical right, not necessarily faulting Jeffrey Caulfield again. Perhaps he was functioning as a cat's paw for an element of CIA who at least wanted to get past the Lee Harvey Oswald, the lone nut communist nonsense. Or perhaps he just, again, didn't want the agency up his butt, which is understandable. The radical right or alt-right was functioning at the operational level with the intelligence community in the murder of the President of the United States. That took place in broad daylight in Dallas, Texas, on November 22, 1963, and people will not discuss it to this day. The truth, that is. I would also note that one of the things that we're going to be talking about is something in some ways analogous to the Charlottesville situation. We're going to be talking about the hate bus. That was a Volkswagen minibus that was basically put together or garnered by American Nazi Party leader George Lincoln Rockwell to serve as a counter-demonstration element to the Freedom Riders. Those were young white students and African Americans who were taking buses to the Deep South in order to help desegregate the South and were sort of taking a cue from Rosa Parks and her attempts at desegregating the Alabama public transit systems. So with the Freedom Riders working against segregation, we are going to take a look at participants in the hate bus operation of George Lincoln Rockwell as a counter, or what today would be called alt-right, counter-demonstration. We're going to begin by taking a look at a letter that was written by Jim Garrison, the New Orleans DA, to Lord Bertrand Russell on August 27th, 1967, almost 41 years ago. Actually, 40 years ago, almost 40 years ago yesterday. No, actually, how time flies and you're having fun. This would have been 50 years ago today, from General Walker and the murder of President Kennedy by Jeffrey Caulfield. And this, again, a letter to Lord Bertrand Russell on August 27th, 1967, almost exactly 50 years ago to the day. Of the Kennedy assassination, Jim Garrison wrote, "Above the operation level, insulated and removed to the point of being very nearly invisible, appeared to have been individuals whose political orientation can only be described as neo-Nazi. Even as I have described this neo-Nazi aspect, I am sure that it sounds somewhat fanciful. Because of the unbelievability of this part of the picture, I have found it necessary to refrain from mentioning it. Nevertheless, the essentially fascist orientation of the assassination is inescapable." And next, we're going to take a look at some aspects of Jim Garrison's investigation of David Ferry, an individual who was named by the House Select Committee on Assassinations as someone whom the Justice Department should investigate in connection with the assassination of JFK. Now, as we move through some of these radical right links to Guy Bannister and some of the many people we have looked at in connection with the assassination of JFK, and there is much material available on the SpitfireList.com website about the JFK assassination. Bear in mind that things like the training camp that was maintained by Garrison and Bannister and Ferry at Lake Pontchartrain and other things go directly to the intelligence community and their use of paramilitary right-wingers against, as foot soldiers, against Fidel Castro. Again, I think that what we're looking at is the employment of an element of a domestic gladio. David Ferry was closely associated with both Guy Bannister and also Carlos Marcello, the capo mafioso of New Orleans, also involved in the killing. And he was very closely associated with Lee Harvey Oswald, dating back to Oswald's teenage years when he worked for David Ferry in the Civil Air Patrol. At the time of his arrest, Oswald had David Ferry's library card in his possession. In what we're about to look at, we're going to see the observations of Glenn Pinchback, who was in the operations command at Fort Sill, Oklahoma. That is an army base. He was involved in intercepting mail, and he speaks of a neo-Nazi plot to enslave America in the name of anti-communism and a neo-Nazi plot gargantuan in scope. I have never seen any other analysis that discusses using anti-communism to enslave America on behalf, he says, neo-Nazi, on behalf of the underground Reich, including some of their radical right street-level foot soldiers whom we're going to look at here. But again, David Ferry, one of Oswald's associates, was named by the House Select Committee on Assassinations as someone whom the Department of Justice should investigate. Of course, that did not take place. From Caulfield's General Walker and the murder, by the way, General Walker's General Edwin Walker, about whom we'll have more to say later, General Walker and the murder of President Kennedy, Garrison did not provide an explanation for all of David Ferry's notes subject matter. However, he did know the meaning of flying Baragona, Baragona, in the beach. Beach, unquote, refers to the model of Ferry's airplane, a beechcraft. Baragona was a Nazi from Fort Sill, Oklahoma. Garrison also obtained a transcript of a letter written by Ferry to Baragona. Next to Baragona's name, Garrison wrote, quote, note, Baragona is important, unquote. The letter had been sent to Garrison by Glenn Pinchback, P-I-N-C-H-B-A-C-K, and a carbon copy was sent to Mendel Rivers, a congressman from Georgia. Pinchback worked in the operations command at Fort Sill, Oklahoma, where he intercepted mail. In the letter, David Ferry shared his dream of the reunification of Germany and living in the world where all the currency was in Deutschmarks. Pinchback's summation of the letter described, quote, a neo-Nazi plot to enslave America in the name of anti-communism and a, quote, neo-Nazi plot gargantuan in scope. The Ferry letter spoke of the need to kill all of the Kennedy brothers and Martin Luther King Jr. Pinchback also reportedly obtained a letter from David Ferry to Baragona confessing his role in the assassination of Robert Gehrig, who was a Nazi and Fort Sill soldier. That last name is spelled just like Lou Gehrig, the Hall of Fame baseball player. Other than RFA 37 or AFA 37, how the United States lost the Second World War, I have never seen any analysis that discusses the Galen Organization and the Underground Reich as using anti-communism to subvert America and to basically conquer America. And that apparently is what Glenn Pinchback is talking about here. I believe that has taken place. More about that perhaps in our next program.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
Now, David Duke has had a lot of press, well, for many years, and he was present in Charlottesville, and people were condemning Donald Trump for not condemning David Duke early enough or forcefully enough. And as we have seen in so many different programs, when you examine Ron Paul, Eddie Snowden, Julian Assange, the milieu of WikiLeaks, Glenn Greenwald, you come back to the milieu of David Duke, neo-Nazis, the neo-Confederate movement, and many others. We'll talk about that in our next program. What we're going to look at here, however, is the evolution of the milieu to which David Duke belongs, and we're going to look at one of Lee Harvey Oswald's Nazi associates, a guy named Ray Lehart, or Lehart, L-E-A-H-A-R-T. He was a New Orleans member of the American Nazi Party, and we're going to take a look at how he is involved with many things here. Now, again, the reference here to the hate bus, that was a Volkswagen minibus that was requisitioned by American Nazi Party Führer George Lincoln Rockwell to ferry American Nazis to confront the Freedom Riders, where many of them did. There were some violent confrontations, not altogether unlike what we saw in Charlottesville. So in a sense, with the hate bus incident, we're looking at sort of a distant antecedent of the Charlottesville incident. And we're going to take a look at Ray Lehart and his connections to Lee Harvey Oswald, to the hate bus incident, to the American Nazi Party, to a fellow named Robert Surrey, S-U-R-R-E-Y. He was a member of the Dallas chapter of the American Nazi Party, a close associate of General Edwin Walker. We've spoken about Walker's links to the Kennedy assassination in many shows, including AFA program number 11, The Guns of November. We spoke about it in our conversation with Dick Russell and his landmark text, The Man Who Knew Too Much. Notice that, again, the Lehart arrest incident in connection with the hate bus disappeared from public view. The Warren Commission showed no interest in it. It did not appear in the FBI documents. New Orleans FBI special agent in charge, Regis Kennedy, was a personal friend of Guy Bannister, a former FBI agent himself. Guy Bannister was the prominent American fascist who worked at one level with elements of the intelligence community, the CIA and the anti-Castro Cuban effort, and at another level with many of these quote alt-right people, that, again, elements of the American Nazi Party, the National States Rights Party, the John Birch Society, the Ku Klux Klan, and the Minutemen. And note here the evolution of this milieu. Note the links to the Kennedy assassination, the aforementioned hate bus incident, an antecedent maybe, or we might say of Charlottesville, to the assassination of JFK, Lee Harvey Oswald, and at a later point in time, Lehart becomes the best man at David Duke's wedding. Jeffrey Caulfield writes about this, saying, "The hate bus rolled into New Orleans after earlier stops in strife-torn Montgomery, Alabama, and Mobile, Alabama, the next day, on an avowed campaign against integration and communism." According to the Nazi Party, the hate bus was sent, quote, "to symbolize the fact that decent Americans do hate and should hate communism and race mixing," unquote. The Nazis followed the itinerary of the Freedom Riders, equal numbers of black and white civil rights workers who began their journey south from Washington, D.C. And skipping down, on December 16, 1963, after the Kennedy assassination, the New Orleans FBI investigated a tip that Lee Harvey Oswald had been seen with Ray Lehart during the previous summer. Layhart was a New Orleans Nazi whom Guy Bannister had bailed out of jail in the hate bus incident. The report is presented here for the first time. Muncie Perkins, clerk, Carrollton Avenue Station, New Orleans Public Service Incorporated, that was the public transit system of New Orleans, residence address 5320 Camp Street, New Orleans, advised that occasionally individuals had been observed by him at the Carrollton Avenue Station in the early morning hours waiting for Ray James Layhart, one of the bus drivers. Mr. Perkins thought that possibly Lee Harvey Oswald may have been among those persons waiting for Ray James Layhart. No FBI documents other than the New Orleans police mugshots from the hate bus arrest were in the FBI record, which raises the question of just what happened to FBI reference 841767D, as in dog, Layhart's arrest record in the hate bus incident, and why it did not accompany the allegation and substantial likelihood of an Oswald Layhart association when sent to the Warren Commission. Guy Bannister's close friendship with New Orleans FBI Special Agent in Charge Regis Kennedy may have had something to do with the critical omission. Garrison's investigators were aware of Layhart, but not of the allegation that he was seen with Lee Harvey Oswald. They had information that Ray Layhart, a city streetcar or bus driver, pasted American Nazi Party slogans and posters on the walls of the Magazine Street bus depot where he worked. Investigators were aware that Layhart had been sent to the training camp across Lake Pontchartrain with Derek Fryer, who was a courier for the Nazi Party. Several allegations that Oswald had been seen in the camp were noted in chapters 1 and 2, and that Fryer's friend Lauren Butler was a high-ranking official in the Nazi Party. According to FBI documents, Ray Layhart and Bluford, B-L-U-F-O-R-B, Balter, B-A-L-T-E-R, were organizers of the New Orleans American Nazi Party. Layhart personally knew George Lincoln Rockwell and had at least 12 personal discussions with Rockwell and even visited him on one occasion in Virginia. Rockwell also met with Layhart, the head of the New Orleans National States Rights Party in New Orleans in September of 1964. In 1961, a special New Orleans edition of the National States Rights newspaper, The Thunderbolt, was issued with the front page headline, Judge Leander Perez Turns Spotlight on the Enemy, unquote, and appeared with a story written by Ray James Layhart above a large photograph of Leander Perez, Guy Bannister's close friend. Guy Bannister subscribed to The Thunderbolt, skipping down. The Dallas FBI office was aware of correspondence linking Layhart to American Nazi Party activities in Texas. One Dallas American Nazi Party member, Robert Suri, was a close associate of General Edwin Walker. Suri's wife, Mary, was Walker's personal secretary. Wealthy oil men reportedly funded Suri's Nazi outfit. Suri printed the infamous Wanted for Treason, unquote, poster, which had circulated in Dallas before the association. The poster pictured mugshot-style photos of President Kennedy and accused him of treason. One more time, this last sentence for emphasis. Last couple sentences. One Dallas American Nazi Party member, Robert Suri, was a close associate of General Edwin Walker. Suri's wife, Mary, was Walker's personal secretary. Wealthy Texas oil men reportedly funded Suri's Nazi outfit. Suri printed the infamous wanted for treason poster which had circulated in Dallas before the assassination. The poster pictured mugshot-style photos of President Kennedy and accused him of treason. Surrey and Walker were Warren Commission witnesses, and of course, Walker was close to both Guy Bannister and Kent Courtney. In the 1970s, Leahart became a leading member in the National Socialist White People's Party, a reconfigured American Nazi Party and Ku Klux Klan outfit, along with David Duke, perhaps the best-known white supremacist in America in the 21st century. Leahart peddled his propaganda along with Duke in what was known as the Free Speech Rally at Louisiana State University in Baton Rouge. On September 9, 1972, Leahart became the best man at David Duke's wedding. By the way, I would add quickly that the Free Speech Rally at LSU is also something of an antecedent to many of the demonstrations, the quote alt-right unquote demonstrations, which are billed as free speech rallies, just as the hate bus incident could be seen as something of an antecedent to what we saw in Charlottesville. Now, what we're going to look at next concerns a guy named Daniel Burroughs. He is an American Nazi Party member. His name and address and phone number were in Lee Harvey, the avowed communist, Lee Harvey Oswald's address book, as were the Arlington, Virginia address and phone number of George Lincoln Rockwell's American Nazi Party. And what we're going to look at next is we're going to talk about Daniel Burroughs and his links to a guy named Roy Frankhauser. Roy Frankhauser is an American Klan member associated with other far-right organizations. As we saw in AFA program number 13, he also functioned as an operation, as a street-level operative for elements of CIA and other elements of the U.S. intelligence community. It was at his home, Frankhauser's home in Reading, Pennsylvania, that Daniel Burroughs allegedly committed suicide after information was surfaced in the New York Times that he was of Jewish ancestry. As Frankhauser noted, a bad case of suicide, 3 bullets, but that's what they said. I will also note here that Roy Frankhauser had apparently links to the Paines, that is Michael Paine and Ruth Paine, both of whom were Lee Harvey Oswald's alleged liberal babysitters or sponsors in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. In fact, they had profound links going to people linked to Project Paperclip. Ruth Paine had links to Alan Dulles' mistress, and in fact, the Paines had profound links to the aerospace industry, the intelligence community, and others. Note that Frankhauser himself, like Lee Harvey Oswald, had effected an at least nominal infiltration of the Socialist Workers' Party. That is an American Trotskyite political party that was the ideological petri dish in which Lyndon LaRouche was cultured. It also was the ideological petri dish in which Bernie Sanders was cultured as well. As I noted, the SWP was so infiltrated by spooks and Nazis that if you went to an SWP meeting and threw a rock in the air, the chances are 9 out of 10 that it would have landed on someone who was either a Nazi or a spook or both. More about that in our next program. I would also note here the National States Rights Party. That is one of the overlapping fascist organizations that is in focus here. That, the American Nazi Party, the Klan, the John Birch Society, and the Minutemen are all heavily overlapped and, in my opinion, again, functioning as elements of a domestic Gladio program. Certainly, they all had links to the intelligence community. Also, note a name here we're going to come back to. And that is a guy named Edward Hunter. In the person of Edward Hunter and also a guy named Harold Lord Varney, we're going to take a look at links that have evolved from the powerful Nazi and fascist fifth column in the U.S. In the pre-World War II and early World War II periods. From, once again, General Walker and the Murder of President Kennedy, of the association between Lee Harvey Oswald associate and American Nazi Party member Daniel Burroughs, and Pennsylvania Klan leader Roy Frankhauser, who also functioned as an operative of CIA, and other elements of the intel community, of the alleged three-bullet suicide of Daniel Burroughs, and Roy Frankhauser's infiltration of the Socialist Workers' Party, along with the alleged infiltration of SAME by Oswald's sponsors, the Paines, we read, one of Daniel Burroughs's favorite books was Undercover, which exposed many well-known right-wingers as Nazis, like Guy Bannister's friend, Edward Hunter, who was an admitted Nazi before World War II. It also exposed a Kent Courtney and Edwin Walker associate Harold Lord Varney, the publisher of the American Mercury, parenthetically the forerunner of the Spotlight and the American Free Press, as a Nazi. After the Kennedy assassination, Burroughs wore a button he designed that read, Lee Harvey Oswald Fan Club, unquote. He became interested in the Ku Klux Klan at a Klan rally in Bear, Delaware. Roy Frankhauser introduced Burroughs to the Imperial Wizard or National Leader of the United Klans of America, Robert Shelton, who cherished Klan members from the North. Frankhauser was the Grand Dragon of the state of Pennsylvania. Shelton swore in Burroughs as Kleagle or Klan organizer, and later as Provisional Grand Dragon of the State of New York. Frankhauser, whose first ties to the Klan were in 1958, reportedly assaulted a police captain during a segregationist rally in October of 1961 in Atlanta, Georgia. Attorneys and prominent leaders in the Klan and the National States Rights Party, J.B. Stoner and James Venable, respectively, defended Frankhauser. Interestingly, Venable intimated not long before he died in the 1990s that Lee Harvey Oswald had visited his Stone Mountain, Georgia home in 1963. It is also worth noting that Stoner served as the attorney for the convicted assassin of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., James Earl Ray. Ray had other interesting attorneys. I would note that his brother, Jerry Ray, was a bodyguard for J.B. Stoner. We talked about that in AFA program number 8.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
Continuing. Burroughs retreated to Frankhauser's home in Reading, Pennsylvania, where upon reading the article exposing his Jewish background, shot himself in the head. Again, according to Frankhauser, a three-bullet suicide. After Burroughs' death, Frankhauser told the New York Times that Burroughs had offered the FBI photostats that connected Lee Harvey Oswald to the Socialist Workers' Party. In a May 18, 1967 FBI memo, an informant told the FBI that Frankhauser had in a secure place letters concerning the assassination of President Kennedy from a person known as Payne. The letters apparently were intended to be given by the informant to Jim Garrison during his investigation, but they never materialized. The information was, however, passed along from the FBI to the Secret Service. Payne was determined to be a reference to Michael Payne, whose wife shared their home with the Oswalds before the assassination. Frank Hauser, in the 1975 interview, claimed that Ruth and Michael Payne had infiltrated the Socialist Workers' Party when he had infiltrated the party in 1960, and that he had met Oswald when the Paynes took him to New York for an international science meeting. So again, note of the many connections here of Daniel Burroughs to Oswald, to Roy Frankhauser. Frankhauser had links to the intelligence community. Note here the discussion of the Paynes, who had numerous links to the intel community, to the defense industry, to Project Paperclip alumni, and who were Lee Harvey Oswald's, quote, liberal sponsors. Note the links here, too, to the Socialist Workers' Party. More about that in our next show. Now, Guy Bannister associate Edward Hunter was, as indicated, a Nazi, along with another associate of Kent Courtney and Edwin Marker, Harold Lord Varney. From the book Undercover, My 4 Years in the Nazi Underworld in America by John Roy Carlson, this book is available for download for free on the SpitfireList.com website. In the books section of Edward Hunter, we read, and again, Edward Hunter is a link from the Nazi Fifth Column in the pre-World War II period to the Nazi underground, I believe, operational level of an American Gladio, involved with elements of the anti-Castro effort, and obviously involved with the assassination of JFK at an operational level, something that could then be pinned on the, quote, radical right if it began to unravel. That, in my opinion, was one of the reasons that Lee Harvey Oswald was also trafficked in connection with domestic fascist organizations, in addition to his most common association, which was with, quote, communists, unquote, like the SWP. Of Guy Bannister associate Edward Hunter, we read from Undercover. Hunter set up shop in 1932 to, quote, to inculcate the principles of Americanism in industrial, religious, fraternal, and educational circles, unquote, under the high-sounding name Industrial Defense Association, Incorporated. That same year, he was contacted by Kurt G. W. Ludecke, L-U-E-D-E-C-K-E, a Nazi agent with whom Hunter became friendly and introduced at the Exchange Trust Company. Here, Ludecke opened a bank account, then tried to induce Hunter to found a chapter of the Swastika League of America. The league actually functioned for a while, but was denied a state charter in Massachusetts. When Hitler came to power a year later, Hunter mysteriously began to receive $300 a month, which he devoted to the publication of an extensive line of pro-Nazi tracts. Even though the Boston Better Business Bureau branded him an anti-Semite, it did not hamper Hunter. But when his role as a Nazi party line follower took an ominous course, the Massachusetts legislature investigated him in 1937. Hunter proved to be an evasive witness. Senator Thomas M. Burke finally asked, quote, question, isn't it true you attempted to create a corporation of the Nazi League in Massachusetts? Hunter answered, yes. Burke then asked, then I say, is it true that you are a Nazi? Hunter, yes, I am. Even though the committee concluded that he carried on, quote, the most vicious activity clearly intended to incite racial and religious hatred, Hunter was released to take up from where he had left off. I dug out a letter he wrote in 1938 to a correspondent. I am acquainted with German-American Bund members and do not want to know any finer or cleaner Americans than they are. I can assure you, 99.9% of the propaganda against the Bund originated in communistic circles. I would advise you to send a couple of dollars to World Service and George Dietrich, D-E-A-T-H-E-R-A-G-E. The addresses of both were given, asking them to place your name on their mailing list. He wrote again, "I cannot understand how any student of radicalism can be misled by the Jewish cry of fascism and Nazism. Fascism is made out of whole cloth by the fathers of liars." That's a quote from the book of John, 8:44. "There is no such animal in America." I would note that tarring anti-Nazi rhetoric as communist and or Jewish is something that was extant in the pre-World War II and World War II period and is done now. It was in evidence in Charlottesville. What we're going to look at next, in a sense, we're going to dolly the camera back, and we're going to take a look at the links between not only General Edwin Walker, but links going through Walker to the post-World War II Nazi underground and overground, in particular, the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, originally formed as the Committee of Subjugated Nations by Adolf Hitler in 1943, that became a key element of the former World Anti-Communist League. It was closely associated with the Galen spy outfit and became a key element of the Republican Party and its ethnic heritage outreach organization. A member of the American Friends of the Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, a guy named Spaz T. Rakin, was the only person to meet Lee Harvey Oswald when he returned from the Soviet Union after having allegedly given top-secret information about the U-2 spy plane and America's radar nets to the former Soviet Union. He not only was not debriefed by the FBI or the CIA, he was not arrested and continued to associate with anti-Castro Cubans, defense industry high rollers, white Russians, and other people whom an alleged communist traitor would not be associating with. Edwin Walker was supposedly a target of Lee Harvey Oswald. A shot was fired at Walker, and this was used by the Warren Commission to show that Oswald was not an ideologically motivated assassin when he killed a liberal president, but had tried to kill a right-winger as well. This information was revealed by Edwin Walker in an interview with the Deutsche National Zeitung and Soldaten Zeitung, edited by Gerhard Fry, 4 days before Marina Oswald supposedly disclosed this information for the first time to the Warren Commission, from General Walker and the murder of President Kennedy. The interview with the Deutsche National Zeitung and Soldaten Zeitung ended with Walker saying, "Give my regards to my German friends, especially Gerhard Fry." Gerhard Fry was editor of the paper, and not only was he a friend of Walker, but unknown to the Warren Commission, he was also a friend of General Charles Willoughby, as we shall see later. Fry and Willoughby were members of the far-right anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations. Willoughby, of course, named Karl Adolf von Scheppel in Wiedenbach, was the German-born fascist admirer of Francisco Franco, who was Douglas MacArthur's G2, the head of MacArthur's military intelligence during World War II. And both Willoughby and Fry are tight with the ABN. Also from General Walker and the murder of President Kennedy, Willoughby was a supporter of the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, and its founder, pro-Nazi Yaroslav Stetsko, was listed on the letterhead of Willoughby's Foreign Intelligence Digest. Stetsko was the World War II leader of the Ukrainian Fascist Collaborationist, OUNB. He was the head of the nominally independent at first state of Ukraine that collaborated with the Third Reich. He then became the single most important figure in the ABN. His personal secretary in the early 1980s. A guy named Roman Zvorich was the Minister of Justice under the Yushchenko government, the equivalent of Attorney General. He then served as Justice Minister under both Timoshenko governments. He was an advisor to Petro Poroshenko and the spokesperson for the Nazi Azov Battalion in Ukraine. The assassination of the OUNB head, Stefan Bandera, allegedly by the KGB, in all probability by CIA, BND, ABN-linked elements, was part of the tarring of Oswald Red as a Soviet assassin. More about these links as we take a look at what took place in Charlottesville in our next program. Again, we've looked at a lot of elements. I hope this is not overly confusing. There will be many links in the written description to this program. This concludes For the Record program number 971, Nazis in New Orleans, being recorded on August 28th of 2017. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.